certainly do appreciate the special music, and it's hard to think about the Passover and to contemplate the Passover and not ponder that question, you know, what can I do to thank you? You know, that was very beautifully done, and I think very appropriate for us, you know, for today's service. We're 3 weeks and a day from the Passover in 2014. It just seems like the 5 months from the time that we finished keeping, you know, the fall feasts have just flown by. And here we are with, you know, the spring season, a beautiful time of the year, and we see the plants, you know, coming back to life, and we see the seasons change, and we see God's systems working the way that they're designed, and we see the beauty that we can behold at this time of the year. Listening to Mr. McCarty, it sounds like examination is on a lot of our minds. Lately, that's been quite a bit on my mind, examinations. If you study a traditional martial art, there are periodic examinations, and that's part of the development process, that's part of the training methodology, that examinations take place periodically to mark the progress that an individual is making. Examinations are only done with the approval of the instructor. It's not something that the student decides that they're going to participate in an examination at any particular time that they want to. That the examinations are generally, according to the various styles, are only done with the approval of the instructor. If you're not ready to test, or if you're deemed by your instructor as not ready to test, then you're not invited to test. So there is an expectation of a successful completion of the examination, but you still have to go through that examining process or that examination process. Typically, the requirements for an examination in a traditional martial art might go something like this, that you would be required to demonstrate the techniques that you had learned over the period of time that you had trained from the last examination until the one that is at hand. You might be required, in most styles, the traditional styles, you'd be required to perform what is called a form. And a form, in Japanese, the term is kata. In Korean, it's pumse. The Chinese call them taolu. That they are a prearranged sequence of movements that that have been created by someone that was prominent in that particular style, maybe hundreds or even, you know, 1,000 years ago or more. And you're required to do, in some cases, all of those forms that you've learned up to the current rank that you've attained. And typically in the martial arts, in the traditional arts, there are two sets of rankings. There are colored belts and then there are black belts. And the colored belts precede the black belts. Typically you will see somewhere around 8 different colored belts, beginning from white, going up through various colors depending on the style until you test for the black belt. And once you are a black belt, then there are different gradings of black belt going up to, in many styles, 8th or 9th dan, as it's called, or 9th step, or the 10th dan in some cases with various styles. But there are periodic, you know, testing and gradings that take place. Most of the styles will use a frequency of something like from 2 to 3 months for the colored belts between examinations. That varies with from style to style. It can be as much as 6 or 7 months, you know, between the gradings. And at the black belt level, there's generally the number of years in continual or constant training required for each one of the belts. And so if you are a first-degree black belt, it's 2 years before you test for the second degree. Once you're promoted to the second dan, then it's 3 years before you're eligible to test for the third dan, and so forth. So depending on the style, it actually becomes a lifelong process of training that, because of those dan gradings or those dan rankings and the time that it takes to be in grade, so to speak, it can add up to a lot of years. So we have the performance of those forms, and we, with each one of the ranks that you test for. And then you may be required to do some type of free sparring, which is, can be a contact type of sparring or non-contact, depending on the style, depending on the objectives that the instructor has for you. And then in some styles, there's what's called breaking, and that is something that would be involved in boards or bricks or some type of material that you demonstrate your capability, with the power that you have achieved with training and the focus that you have to be able to put that power into a small space in a compressed period of time and demonstrate that you can break boards or bricks or whatever in a variety of different techniques. And different techniques are required, you know, for some of the, for the different, different rankings. So that's some of the components that go into an examination in martial arts. Another aspect of the test goes like this, and in specifically many of the Taekwondo styles have, that are Korean in origin, have what are called the five tenets. And a tenet is a credo or a belief, as opposed to a tenet, which is someone that you're renting a room to. So the five tenets of Taekwondo are courtesy, integrity, perseverance, self-control, an indomitable spirit. An indomitable spirit is that approach to things, or that spirit where you never give up, you never quit. You know, you persevere, you try to persist regardless of how difficult things may be. So those are the five tenets. You're tested also in the five tenets as a part of the examination. The instructor may, and depending on their particular personality or their particular bent in the examination, they may ask you to do something very unexpected. And when you run into some of those unexpected type of tests, your first response may be, we didn't train for that. I can't do that. We've never been taught that. But if you demonstrate that, then you are demonstrating, no, I really don't comprehend the courtesy, the perseverance, the self-control to manage my emotions and to just do the best that you can with what you have to do with. And so those tenets are tested, along the way, both in class and in the examination by the instructor. The expectation is that over a period of time, the individual will begin to exhibit those five tenets. And those five tenets will become evident in how that person, that student, treats other students, treats the instructor, or as they move into the role of an instructor, how they treat their students. And that is an expectation that is a part of many of the styles. It can be a character-based activity with focus on character building as well as, the physical skill building. When it comes to examinations, you're either ready or you're not. There's no way to cram for an examination like this. The only way that you prepare is by regular practice. There is no way that you can not train regularly and then somehow be ready to test, ready to participate in an examination. It's just not possible. And I think many times our trials are that way too. The Christian journey is one that requires persistence and perseverance. It's not something that we can cram for at the last minute. You know, we're either ascribing to the Christian way of life, the Christian walk of life, or we're not. That's just the way that it seems to work. After the examination's over, then there will be a promotion to, if you've successfully completed the examination, then you're promoted to the next rank, and then that cycle starts all over again. And you train for a period of time, and you learn new techniques, and then you go through that same examination process, over time. You know, today we're just 3 weeks and 1 day from the Passover in 2014, as I mentioned a little bit ago. God willing, we'll keep the Passover here, or many of us will, Sunday night, April the 13th. It will be, again, as they all are, a very special time. I'd like to look, in the time that I have remaining this afternoon, at one aspect of preparing for the Passover, and that being examination, the same thing that Mr. McCarty spoke about a little bit ago. But I'd like to look at examination. If we would, let's turn to 1 Corinthians and let's read some verses that preceded one of those that Mr. McCarty read, and we'll read beginning in 1 Corinthians 11 and we'll read 23 to 29. Most of the verses that I have this afternoon are either going to be in 1 or 2 Corinthians. There are a couple others that I'll just read to you for the sake of time, but for the most part, I'd like to spend the time in 1 Corinthians 11 and one other scripture a little bit later in 2 Corinthians. But 1 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 23. And I'm reading from the New King James Version. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. Now, there are some that have this particular belief in Protestant theology or in the Protestant world, that Jesus Christ interprets the Old Testament and the Apostle Paul interprets Jesus Christ. I think 11:23 is a pretty good refutation of that particular position out of the mouth of the Apostle Paul and by his own words. He's not saying, I brought something new and different. This isn't my interpretation of Jesus Christ. The Apostle Paul saying, I'm bringing to you what I was taught, what I received from Jesus Christ. And I think he demonstrates a submission to the authority of Jesus Christ in that statement that's a good lesson for us all. Verse 24, and when he had given thanks, he, being Jesus Christ, he broke it and said, take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And we'll do that, you know, and we've done that for, in some cases, many decades, where we've kept the Passover, and we have partaken of the New Testament symbols here, or of the symbols of the New Testament Passover that the Apostle Paul brings out here in this section that he received at the instruction of Jesus Christ, and we'll do this in remembrance of Jesus Christ. Verse 25, in the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. And that same thing. Both of those two symbols, you know, the bread, the broken bread, and the blood, and the wine symbolizing blood, you know, do this in remembrance of me. Continuing in 26, for as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. And then 27 begins with a therefore. So this is a conclusion of what's been stated, some of these verses that have been stated prior to this. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. You know, the King James uses the word unworthily in that place. And, you know, in years past, in the church, there would be some that would, after their examination or as the Passover approaches and we're directed to look at ourselves and to examine ourselves, that we would draw the wrong conclusion here, and we'd say, I'm not worthy to keep the Passover. And so there would be the struggle with, what should I do? You know, I don't think I'm worthy to take the Passover. Maybe I shouldn't go. And so in times past, the ministry would have to deal with that to help the person to understand that none of us are worthy. None of us nor all of us are worthy of the death of Jesus Christ. You know, we're humans. He was spirit. He was God in the flesh. None of us are worthy. But it's talking about the manner in which we take it. And in an unworthy manner. And so I think the New King James in its wording is very helpful in avoiding that false conclusion that we've somehow got to be worthy of taking the Passover, which we're not worthy, but that's not the point here. You know, the point is that it's discussing taking the Passover in an unworthy manner. Now, what might that be? Let me just read to you a verse out of Hebrews that talks about the gravity and the seriousness of the manner in which we take the Passover and how we look at Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and what he's done for us and the plan that God has put into place for our salvation going back to the time it's mentioned in Hebrews as before the foundation of the world. Let me read Hebrews 10:29 to you out of the New King James. And this I think has an excellent description of the seriousness of what taking the Passover is about. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace? So it's saying, you're in a real serious and a real dangerous place if you take this lightly. If you take this in a cavalier manner, if you don't take this, you know, if you don't take the Passover in a manner that as best as we're able to do as human beings to comprehend, you know, the magnitude of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And that it's saying, when you take the Passover, do so to the best of your capability, you know, understanding what has been done for you. Don't do this in a cavalier manner. You know, and in many, many years past, we kept the Passover in a very solemn and in a very grave manner. And over a period of time, over actually several decades, you know, I noticed that, you know, you would see, or I would perceive that there'd be a little more joy in the congregation. And at first I was a little bit alarmed by that because I thought, are we moving into an area where we're not properly appreciating the sacrifice and the symbols and what we're doing here? But I really believe that what that was an expression, a godly expression of joy at the appreciation and an expression of appreciation for the symbolism of the Passover and what Jesus Christ has done for us. Because it wasn't done in a manner of hilarity, but it was done and is done in a joyful manner. But it's a really serious thing. And I think Hebrews 10:29 very much applies to, you know, the unworthy manner. And it talks about how serious this is and to not do this in just a flippant or a cavalier, you know, manner, but to do so, you know, having really thought about and really focused on what that sacrifice does for each of us and for all of us. Continuing in 28. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. That's a conjunction right there to that but let him, you know, and then the rest of that clause connecting with, you know, with the verses that have gone before. We're supposed to examine ourselves, and then what? We say, well, I'm not worthy or whatever, and so I can't take the Passover or shouldn't take the Passover. It's not what it says, not what it means. Let a man examine himself, or let a person examine him or herself, and then so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. You know, it's not something that is conditional. The examination has nothing to do with the taking of the symbols. The examination is to be done, and then the Passover is to be partaken of. Continuing in 29, last verse in this section. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment, or damnation, as some of the other translations say, to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. Not discerning the Lord's body. I think we can read that a lot of different ways. And we can say that, you know, we can look at the Lord's body as the body, the church of God. Are we discerning the church? You know, and the other is, are we discerning, you know, Jesus Christ, the body of Jesus Christ and what he did for us? Let's take a look at that phrase, let a man examine himself. And let's look at what does examine mean? What does examine mean? You know, in some ways, we might take a look at examination like this. We might say, oh, it's a comparison. So I'm going to compare myself with somebody else. Well, I think I'm doing quite a bit better than so-and-so here. Ooh, well, if I compare myself to this individual, they're a lot more spiritual than I am, so I don't feel quite as good with that. Let me read to you 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12 that I think very much bears on this. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. For we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. Revised Standard Version says that they are without understanding. So it's not a comparison that we do of matching ourselves up against other people in the congregation. You know, it is a self-analysis, and we'll look here in a little bit about some thoughts about what we might be comparing ourselves to or against in that sense. If you look at Strong's, it has a section typically in at least the online version that it's an outline of biblical usage. The outline of biblical usage for the word examine is this, and I'll read some of these. Synonyms are always very helpful for me because in my case it helps me to better understand some of the meanings of a particular word. Some of you may not have that problem. You may be able to, you know, zero in on the word itself and get that, the significance of it, you know, just with the statement of the word and your comprehension of it. But for me, it's synonyms and antonyms are very helpful in being able to understand, you know, more deeply and more fully the meaning of a word or a concept. Outline of biblical usage for examine. Here's one. To test, to prove, to scrutinize, and that is to see whether a thing is genuine or not. And this aspect or this, there is an aspect that's mentioned for two different Greek words that are translated examine that have to do with this. And I wasn't able to find a really succinct treatment of this, but they said that prove had to do with being able to determine whether the ancient coins were really counterfeit or not. And it said that there would be, you know, a process. Sometimes they were subjected to heat and they were assayed or analyzed and studied to see if this coin is really what it's, you know, if it's of the, has the value that it said that does, or if it's just a counterfeit. It was a lot more difficult in days gone by to keep coins from being, or counterfeit coins from being struck. One particular source said something like this, that after a coin had been studied, that it might be stamped with, that this coin is approved. It's the real thing. It's genuine. And then there was the coin with the abbreviation for the opposite of that Greek word that said, this thing is counterfeit. This is worthless. This is anti-approved. You know, it's not genuine. It's counterfeit. So there's that aspect of examining as proving that we're not counterfeit. You know, proving that we're the real thing, to use that term. Second section on that outline of biblical usage is this. To recognize as genuine after examination, almost a restatement of the same thing, to approve or to deem worthy. So when we talk about examine, that's the significance of it, you know, to scrutinize and to determine if it's genuine or if it's a counterfeit. This particular word examine is translated in several different ways in the New Testament. I'll just read the individual ways that, or words that are used and that are translated from this Greek word, to prove. And again, in that same sense as to, you know, proof of the validity or of the genuine nature of this coin, 10 times in the New Testament, to try. You know, and that is by trial to examine if this is genuine or not. To approve, to discern, and then to examine. There's also a section in some of the online helps, and it's called Trench's Synonyms. And this is actually a very erudite, you know, presentation that's way beyond my language capability, because it's a discussion of the Greek and things like this. But there's a couple of sentences in here that I really liked. It says, from Trench's, again, talking about the word for examine, putting money to the proof, putting money to the test. And again, we're back to those coins, you know, and to go through this process that determines whether it's the real thing or not. It says, but there follows for the most part not merely a victorious coming out of the trial, but it is further implied that the trial was itself made in the expectation and hope that the issue would be such. At all events, with no contrary hope or expectation. Very flowery language. I'd probably state it like this. You wouldn't be tried if you weren't expected to succeed. And again, back to martial arts, you're not invited to test unless you're deemed ready to be promoted, and that there is the expectation of a positive outcome. And I believe so it is with us. We're not tested with the expectation that we're going to fail. We're tested with the expectation, and we examine ourselves with the expectation that we're going to come through this, that we are going to be successful, that we're going to succeed. Jameson Fawcett Brown has this one thing to say about one of the preceding verses about let him eat. You know, let him eat partake of the Passover. It says, his self-examination is not in order that he may stay away, but that he may eat, that is, communicate. It's the same type of an approach, that we examine ourselves and then we keep the Passover. we don't examine ourselves in order to keep the Passover. The examination is a prerequisite, is a part of it. But we're directed, we're commanded, keep the Passover. I'd like to offer for consideration some things that we might examine. And you can almost take the approach of just flip your Bible open to any page and you look at those verses and we can say, or I can look at it and say, am I doing that? You know, is this the way I live my life? Is this my attitude? Is this my response to, you know, the various stimuli or not? In some cases, I can say, that's okay. And then in others, I have to look at myself, and as Mr. McCarty brought out, you know, we have to look at ourselves honestly, and we'd have to say, no, yeah, I'm not doing that very well at all. Not doing that well at all. And that's something that I need to focus on and to try to, with God's help, to make some progress in. These are some of the things that I'd like to offer for consideration and some things that I like to review and think about, you know, as the Passover approaches. And I like to start with looking at my baptismal commitment. What did I say I was going to do? And, you know, remember back when whoever it was that counseled you for baptism or that whoever baptized you might have done this, you know, as part of the baptizing process, you would have discussed and read maybe Luke 14, 25 to 33. You know, here's what you are preparing to publicly profess, that you are going to love less by comparison, and then there's a fairly exhaustive list, and it's a very significant list. You're going to love less by comparison your wife, your children, your family, and on it goes. You profess that your priorities are going to change to where you're going to put God first in your life. From this time forward, as best you're able and with God's help, you're going to try to walk in newness of life with God's Holy Spirit, which you'll receive, you know, a little down payment of, a little earnest of at the conclusion of that baptism. And some minister lays hands upon you, on your head, and prays to God that you receive the Holy Spirit, and you do. And so periodically I like to go back and look at, you know, how am I doing on that? You know, am I really living up to that commitment? You know, I made a vow that this was what I was going to do. So am I doing that or not? You know, and each of us has to look at ourselves and in our situations and see, you know, how we measure up to those words in Luke 14. But at some point, all of those of us that are baptized said, yep, that's what I'm going to try to do. That's what my plan is. I'm convicted. I accept the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for my sins, and this is what I'm going to try to do for the rest of my life. I like to review the Ten Commandments, both literally and with respect to motive. And motive is where it really gets ugly for me. You know, and I have to look and say, and we read some of the verses in the New Testament when it talks about motive and attitude, and it's not just the physical act only, but we start looking at now, what's in your heart? You know, if you hate somebody, that's murder. You know, so how am I doing with that? You know, I haven't killed anybody physically, but what's in my heart? You know, each of us has to look at that and see, you know, how we measure up to that standard and to all of those commandments, the two great commandments. You know, do I love God with all of my heart? And how am I doing with how I treat my neighbors? You know, and then we understand very clearly who is my neighbor. You know, we have parables that explain that. But how do I do when it comes to treating my neighbors? You know, I have to say sometimes I think do okay, and other times that, wow, I've got some improvement to make in how I work with my neighbor, how I interact with my neighbors, my expectation of my neighbors. I've been thinking a lot about this verse in Matthew. I'd like to read it to you. All of you have read it dozens of times, heard it many times, but I'd like to read this in context of what I've just said. Matthew 23 and verse 27, I'll read it to you out of the New King James. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You say one thing and you do something else. You ascribe this standard, but your conduct is very different. That's what a hypocrite is. For you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Very graphic, picturesque language about the perception of something on the outside and the reality of what is truly on the inside of a sepulcher or of a tomb. I don't know about you, but sometimes I have to look at myself and I think, wow, I just slapped on a nice fresh coat of paint. Didn't change a thing about what's down deep in my heart. But I've got a fresh coat of paint on, so maybe I look pretty good. And I have to look at myself in that and I think, wow, you know, when I start analyzing myself and when I start examining myself, you know, what's really on the inside? What's coming from the inside? And to assess my changes or my perceived changes, that is this something that's just exterior? Is this just the persona, the mask that we, you know, we put up and how we portray ourselves to others in our interactions? Or is this something that is truly something that God is changing, you know, in my heart from the inside out? And that the change that's taking place in my heart by the power of God's Spirit manifests itself in the following manner. And hopefully that's pleasing to God. But that's the contrast. Is it just exterior, fresh coat of paint? Or is it something that truly is from the inside? And it's from the inside coming out. I like to review the Beatitudes and take a look at the things that the parables and the sayings in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. You know, and you look at each one of those and you go through those and you say, well, you know, am I a peacemaker? You know, and some of those different things, and to phrase some of those in the form of a question by way of how we examine ourselves or how I examine myself, and to go through some of those sections there. And you know, it doesn't take very long to read those, but there are some powerful, powerful statements there. You know, the conduct that we are expected. I think we can look at 1 Corinthians 13, you know, the love chapter. We can say, do I bear all things? You know, do I believe all things? Do I hope all things? And go through those different sections there in 1 Corinthians 13. And there's a lot of powerful material in just a very short, you know, few short verses there. And lastly, I think, you know, to take a look at Galatians 5, you know, to look at the fruits of the Spirit. You know, is that something that is that evident in my life? You know, is this something that is coming from me and that is growth spiritually? And, you know, to look at those things and to see, you know, what it is that, how do I assess myself in that? How do I, what's the result of that? And these are just a few things. And I you know, if any of you later have particular areas that you look at or think about, I'd appreciate hearing about those. It's different, maybe a little bit different for all of us. If you would, let's turn over to the second scripture that I'd like to focus on. It's over in 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. Very similar words. Very similar words. Examine your spouse whether they be in the faith. And I think sometimes that'd be a little easier than what it actually says, isn't it? Examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. And I think there's something a little more interesting, you know, about examining somebody else than being examined. You know, I know that, you know, back to the role of martial arts, you know, if you participate in the conducting the examination, it's a totally different perspective than if you're out there being directed to do some of those things that I mentioned earlier. And in this particular case, you know, I thought about that a little bit, you know, when we think of examining, you know, examination, all of these are self, or they're directed to us individually. You know, it's not our issue to examine somebody else. You know, I've got to focus on me. 2 Corinthians 13:5, examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. Prove your own selves. And we're back to prove in that sense of, is it counterfeit or is it genuine? You know, that use of the the analogy with metals. You know, is this really gold, or does it just look like gold? You know, is this coin really, you know, a $20 gold piece, or is it something that is a fake and it's worthless? Know you not your own selves how that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be reprobate. Reprobate doesn't help me much. That's not a word I use a whole lot and don't really understand a lot about that, but some of the other translations help me with that. I'll read three different ones. Instead of except you be reprobates, another translation says this, unless, of course, you fail the test. Know you not your own selves how that Jesus Christ is in you unless you fail the test? Unless you are counterfeits, the substitution for that last clause. That Jesus Christ is in us unless we are counterfeit, unless we're failing the test. Or in the last section, or the last one, the example that I have here, unless disqualified. Unless disqualified. And this is actually a different Greek word than the one in 1 Corinthians 11:28. From Strong's Greek lexicon, this word can mean to try, to make trial of, to test, for the purpose of ascertaining its quality. It's that same concept, you know, of what he thinks or how he will behave himself. I'd like to focus for a minute on the simple little phrase there in the last part of in the first part of the verse. Examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. I had great expectations when I started going to the commentaries about in the faith. I expected to see, you know, lots written and some very helpful things about that. No luck. Not even Matthew Henry, as flowery and as verbose as that commentary is, was much help. Jameson Fawcett Brown didn't even discuss it. So that was not very helpful at all. But I thought about that, you know. Examine yourselves whether you're in the faith. What could that mean? I'd like to offer for consideration that we go back to the first verse that I read, 1 Corinthians 11:23. For this I receive from the Lord. You know, what has been delivered to us over the years? And we have Mr. McCullough here, that he has preached in this area for decades. You know, he taught what was delivered to him. You know, and I think that's an aspect of what it means to be in the faith. How do we match up, how do we line up with what has been delivered to us over the years, and that which we can prove that is genuine and is correct out of the pages of the Bible, and that it's sound doctrine? How do I, as an individual, match up to that? Examine myself whether I'm in the faith, whether I'm living up to what has been delivered to me, you know, over the years. I'd like to read a couple of verses that use that phrase. And if you do a word study on this phrase, looking specifically for in the faith, there's something like 12 or 14 different, you know, usages in the New Testament. It's an interesting word study to just read those scriptures to see, you know, what other, you know, writers in the New Testament, what surrounds that phrase of in the faith. But I want to read just two of those. The first one is 1 Corinthians 16:13, that says this: watch, stand fast in the faith. Stand fast in the faith. Be brave, be strong. And for the stand fast in the faith, it can mean this: to stand firm, to persevere, to persist, to keep one standing. Well, what's our standing? Hopefully we are members of the body of Jesus Christ, you know, the Church of God, that we keep that standing, that we remain in the faith, that we're true to what has been delivered to us. Adam Clark had this one thing at various places that I checked that commentary. And again, some of these commentaries are 200-300 years old, so the language is very different from what we use today, and some of the expressions are more difficult to understand. But he's had this to say about this comment about the clause, stand fast in the faith. Hold in conscientious credence what you have already received as the truth of God. I like that. Conscientious credence. Hold in conscientious credence what you have already received as the truth of God. I like that. Second verse that I'd like to read to you about in the faith is from the passage Colossians 1:21-23. Colossians 1, verses 21 to 23. And I'd like to read the verses there at the beginning of that to that precede the use of that expression. And you who were once alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he has reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and blameless and above reproach in his sight. And that's what the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that we accept does for us in the sight of God. That God doesn't look at us and or look at me and say, you got 5,311 things that you need to correct. And I'm thankful that I'm not looked at in that same way. But when I examine myself and I start looking to how I match up and how I assess myself with some of those areas that I mentioned earlier, I think, wow, I got a lot of work to do. I don't match up very well on some of those. Some of those I match up, I match up pretty poorly. Continuing, above reproach in his sight. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. If you continue in the faith, and I think that's a challenge that we all have. And here we are this afternoon, we're a few dozen. You know, we have all, or most of us have sat in services where there were above 1,000 people. Had the privilege one time with many of you to keep the Passover on the college campus in Big Sandy with 1,656 people that kept the Passover. Largest group that kept the Passover that I've personally ever seen. And now we look at, where are all these people? Where have they gone? You know, we all have friends, family, close acquaintances, and people that made other choices. You know, and they will have to answer for their choices just as we have to answer for ours. But this time for me, this time of the year is always sobering because you go back and you look at those, you think about those times in the past and Passovers that we've kept in different places, and we see, wow, it's very different now. It's very different. Some things we look at our experience and we think, nothing's changed. I'm still trying to walk in newness of life for as long as I have physical life, with my goal as the kingdom of God, having the hope of salvation, and that if Jesus Christ returns in my lifetime, that's fine. If I rest in the grave waiting for that resurrection, that's fine too. But my goal is the same. And here we are. I don't think there's a person among us that thought we'd be keeping the Passover in 2014. I kept my first Passover in the field house in Big Sandy in April of 1968. Some of you, I know Mr. Neff kept the Passover. I believe his first one was 1952 or 1953. You know, same goal. We have that same expanse of time that, you know, as we rehearse the plan of God again, we're reminded of the significance of what we set our hand to. You know, and we're exhorted to keep on keeping on. Got to tell you a Mr. McCullough story right quick before I quit. And any of you that have ever had a class under Mr. McCullough have heard him say that, and it's probably a quote, and if I'm wrong, those of you that have taken classes can correct me. But things might go a little bit like this. George, Charlie, and I might be talking on an evening to say, do you think Mr. McCullough's going to give us the test tomorrow in such and such class? George would say, no, I don't think so. I think he's got this or that on his mind. He's doing this or that. I don't think we're gonna have a test. Charlie might say, oh, I think we're due. I don't think we haven't had a test in a while. I'm staying here and studying. So I'd be thinking, well, do I want to go with George and, you know, have fun tonight doing this, that, or the other, or should I do what Charlie's doing and stay here in the study area and get ready for the test? So we'd show up to the class the next day, and we'd hear those words that would say from Mr. McCullough, would you take out a clean piece of paper? He thought, uh-oh. It's examination time, and then you'd think, George, I'll never trust you again. Should have stayed with Charlie. But I was thinking about that a little bit yesterday and today about those words from Mr. McCullough. You know, take out a clean piece of paper and think, it's time for an examination. It's here. You know, we'll see if I was ready, then I think, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. You know, I think I'm ready for what he's going to examine us on. And there's other times that I think I knew I shouldn't have gone with George. You know? But again, I hope that as we prepare for the Passover and we think about examining ourselves, that we can look at where we've been, where we are, where we're going. We can revisit our commitments. And that we can come to Passover or take the Passover wherever we might here on Sunday night, April the 13th, and we can do what the Apostle, you know, Paul wrote about there, that we can go back and read the, I'll read those verses again. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. And hopefully we'll do that and we'll participate in the Passover and wherever you go and whoever you keep the Passover with, I hope you have a spiritually rich and invigorating evening and that we can come out of that with the expectation and the determination to persist and to persevere and to walk in newness of life.